Welcome to Let It Roll, the story of how and why rock and roll happened with Ed Ward and Nate Wilcox. It's time to let it roll. Today features the return of Ed Ward to discuss his book, Michael Bloomfield, The Rise and Fall of an American Guitar Hero, which is coming out in paperback this summer. As always, you can access our YouTube playlists and learn more about the episodes on our website, letitrollpodcast.com. This week, Ed and I talk about the rise of Michael Bloomfield, his legend, his unique role as a Jewish blues man who learned at the feet of Muddy Waters and other African-American players in Chicago, his role in helping Bob Dylan birth folk rock, and his pioneering innovations with the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy. Welcome back to the Let It Roll podcast. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and joining us is our original guest, Ed Ward, who's here to talk about his book, Michael Bloomfield, The Rise and Fall of an American Guitar Hero. Ed, why does Michael Bloomfield matter?
Well, I mean, he was actually the first white American flashy blues guitarist. And that gets into an even more complicated thing. It wasn't just that he was flashy. It was that he was playing real blues with an electric guitar in a time when blues was supposed to be played on acoustic guitars by frail old black men. He sort of challenged a lot of people's preconceptions.
And he was also the first rock and roll guitar virtuoso.
Yeah, exactly. There were others who were completely unknown at the time, particularly in Britain, which was not someplace one would go looking for blues. Alexis Corner, of course, was running his various bands, and he was not that he was a great virtuoso, but he attracted people who were. But Michael came up very naturally in a context where it never occurred to him that he was, you know, forging a whole new paradigm for the guitar.
And at the beginning of the book, I mean, there's definitely a mythical aspect of Michael Bloomfield because he's the proverbial white boy who can play the blues, and not just like in his bedroom, but as in on stage with Muddy Waters in Southside of Chicago.
Right.
And so you kind of capture that in the opening chapter when you bring up this comparison with Robert Johnson. And you end with this sentence, you know, Robert Johnson of the Crossroads myth, where he goes to the crossroads of Highway 61 and something else at midnight and waits for this mysterious dark figure to come tune his guitar, allegedly. That's the legend. And it's a legend Bloomfield was familiar with, because that was about all we knew about Robert Johnson in Bloomfield's
right.
era. What's the tie-in? I mean, you end with this line, Satan is irrelevant to our story, but Robert Johnson is not. Can you explain?
Well, it's partially because of the myth. At the time that Michael burst onto the scene, the national scene, really all that was known about Johnson was one LP that John Hammond at Columbia Records had cobbled together. We knew nothing about his life. We knew nothing about anything but these recordings. And so this myth of the crossroads and so forth, you know, was very, very heavy. Turns out that actually was a legend attributed to Tommy Johnson, who was a far more famous guitarist in his own time, who quickly drank himself to death. But Michael was haunted in the way that Robert Johnson was alleged to be. You know, he had his own demons, and they eventually brought him down. But initially, he was just a kid from the Chicago suburbs.
And he was a pretty wealthy kid. Tell us about his background.
Yeah. Well, his family was the Bloomfield Restaurant Supply. And I often tell people, if you've ever been to a diner, and there's a container of sugar with a dome top and a flap on it, that was invented by Bloomfield. If you look at the bottom of those things, they've either got a B in a circle or the words made in Chicago. and that's the Bloomfield Company. But they did far, far more than that. They did all kinds of stainless steel stuff and salt shakers and, you know, spoons and forks and stuff like that. It was a restaurant supply company, one of the most successful in the United States.
And so
his father obviously wanted him to go into that business. Instead, it was his younger brother who did.
And Michael was never a promising student or chip off the old block for his dad.
No, he really wasn't. He was really, he was a lot closer to the model of his mother, who, when she married his father, was a successful entertainer, doing dinner theater and nightclub gigs. She was a singer. She was really a beautiful woman. And so, you know, she was used to being in front of the public. And when she saw that Michael was developing in this way, she really encouraged him, which didn't really please his father very much.
I mean, it's a classic conflict between the son and the father. And Michael was precocious musically. Like, not only is he in Chicago, which might be the very best place to be an American music fan in that point in time, but he's picking up the guitar at age 12.
Right. And like he said, he was really terrible for a year, and then he got good.
I think he said he got great.
I'll never forget him. What?
I think the quote is he got great. Which,
right, that's what he said. Yeah.
Which is amazing. It's very typical of Bloomfield. I mean, he's this character who has enormous self-confidence on the one hand and also a ton of neuroses and self-doubts.
Right. Well, it was possible for them to coexist. You know, pick up a guitar and say, I'm going to beat you, Michael. And that will turn him on to doing everything he can to shut you down. I mean, it's a classic thing that they do in the clubs in Chicago. But other things, yeah, he wasn't so good at.
Yeah, and so tell us a little bit about Michael's listening menu, like the kind of stuff that he discovered in the 50s, because it really, I mean, it sounds like he's like the hippest kid alive.
Yeah, well, he wasn't alone. That's the main thing. There were other kids who were doing this, and he eventually connected with them. But they had a maid. They had a colored maid, like all good Jewish families. And she took him to the club. She knew Muddy Waters. She knew Big Bill Brunzi. She knew a lot of the blues singers. And she enjoyed it. And she thought, well, Michael, you're playing guitar. You should come see this stuff. So with permission from his parents, she took him down to these clubs. And he was electrified. But it was really true. It wasn't just Muddy Waters and the great stars. There were tons of guitar players out there in Chicago, loads of them. It was no big thing. I imagine if he'd been a country fan, Chicago would also have been an excellent place to be, because as well as the black migration, black rural people coming north, there were white rural people coming north. And so had he had that inclination and talent and exposure, you know, that would have been great. The main thing was he was like, you know, this young teenager who wanted to be tough. He saw Elvis and he's like, that's what I want to be, man. I want to be tough. And he saw blues as a way to be tough. You know, instead of beating other kids up with your fists, you beat them up with the guitar. You think you're good? Well, watch this.
And that was good. He had that outlet, since apparently he wasn't coordinated enough to beat anybody up with his fists.
Right.
But you know, you also talk about his radio diet. And in Chicago, you could pick up quite a lot of radio stations. He was listening to Nashville.
Well, there were a lot of radio stations. Not so many of the clear channels, because there were a lot of local stations on the AM dial, and you can't have them too close together. So I don't think he, unlike, you know, Bob Dylan up in rural Minnesota, I don't actually think he was listening to the clear channels, you know, from Nashville and maybe XCRB in wherever that was in Mexico. He was paying attention to what was on the local station. Now, a lot of them, their blues programming was only late at night. And during the day, they'd have jazz or something. You know, there were radio stations that were marketing themselves toward black people. And the Chess Brothers, in fact, owned one. I can't remember the name of it. But, you know, the radio stations and the record companies, and they were all intertwined. And so there was a lot of the stuff on the radio, because these people who had moved north to make money had made money. And so here they were, ready to advertise to.
And so he's playing, and he begins playing in the blues clubs really early, but he's also playing in rock and roll bands on the north side of Chicago, and then sneaking to the south side.
Right, because
that
was a way that that was something other kids in his school were doing. Here he was just wanting to get out and perform. And he did the talent show at his high school and stuff like that. But it wasn't at all unusual. A lot of kids were forming bands around then. You know, they heard, you know, Link Wray. They heard The Ventures, things like that. And they were ready to go. You know, it was a way to get girls to look at you.
But then when he's 18, he puts down the electric guitar entirely.
Right. Well, the thing that was hipper than, you know, trying to be The Ventures was folk music. And once again, a big source of girls. And it was also a thing that set you apart as a rebel. And he had that instinct all the time to rebel. The folk thing was coming up. He was eventually going to go to the University of Chicago. And that was right in the middle of all of it. And it was a big, big folk scene. I mean, coming up in the folk scene in New York, I heard about Chicago and what a radical folk scene it was. You know, among other things, they were looking at the local scene, at all the stuff that was in clubs.
And some of the stuff in clubs includes a man named Big Joe Williams, who Bloomfield spent a lot of time with and really encouraged. Did Bloomfield bring Big Joe into the folk audiences, or was Big Joe already playing for those folk audiences?
What Michael did was he eventually took over the booking of a club called the Fickle Pickle. And he also knew from his scholarship that there had been previously a huge blues scene in Chicago, but it was mostly acoustic. This stuff was documented largely on Bluebird Records, which was a division of RCA, which was intended to provide hillbilly and Negro hit records that weren't jazz. So there was a big Tampa Red and Maceo Merriweather and Arthur Crudup. These people all recorded for Bluebird. Washboard Sam was another one. And it was sort of like Blue Note Records was for jazz later. You'd have a session, and then you'd figure out who to put on the label for a given individual recording. They just recorded these people playing together and put out the records and sort of threw them against the wall. Now, the advantage of that was it was really cheap to make the records. The disadvantage was they all sounded alike. So they weren't as successful as they wanted to be. They had a huge hit with Lil Green, Romance in the Dark. Past that, Bluebird was not all that successful. But all these musicians, they'd come up with the northern migration of black southerners, and they wanted to play, so they played in clubs and so forth. And eventually, their audience aged out. So these guys were just sitting around with all these skills and nowhere to exercise them. And Michael thought, aha, this is something the folkies are going to like. And so he started booking these people into the Fickle Pickle. He did have a particular friendship with Big Joe, who was a naturally gregarious guy with a horrible temper. And so he and some of his friends sort of started taking care of him.
Bloomfield and some of his friends started taking care of Big Joe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you tell a classic tale of kind of how the friendship ends when Big Joe leads Bloomfield on sort of an expedition to East St. Louis that was supposed to be a music hunt, but ends up Big Joe wanted to see his family.
It was a little too real for somebody who up to that point had idealized these guys as like, you know, great artists, lost masters. And here's this guy, you know, here's Michael asleep on somebody's couch. And here's this guy with a pig snout on a meat fork holding up above his, hey, Michael, try some of this, you know, and there's like pork fat dripping on this poor Jewish kid's chest as Big Joe is like drunk out of his mind and waving a barbecued pig snout around. And, you know, that was just a little too real. And I think that's, you know, you have to sort of adjust your expectations when something like that happens.
Yeah, I mean, basically Bloomfield jumped in his car and went back to Chicago and left Big Joe behind. And apparently they patched it up, or at least, you know, Bloomfield said that Big Joe comes with him. How about that big time we had in St. Louis? And that was the only thing that was said about the fight they had.
Right, because Big Joe didn't have a plan. He was famous for being unfindable. He signed up with Bob Kester, Delmark Records, after a while, which was a Chicago label that, you know, specialized in blues and jazz. And, you know, when Kester wanted to do a session with Big Joe, or somebody from a folk festival had called, it was a day's work trying to figure out if he was even in town. He was just famous for wandering around.
And Bloomfield, for a while, was happy to wander in his footsteps. So Bloomfield's not the only white kid getting involved in the blues scene in Chicago at this time. I mean, Nick Gravanides, Paul Butterfield, and a guy named Charlie Musselwhite are all doing the same thing. And Musselwhite's the first one that Bloomfield starts playing with in this thing they called the group.
Right, which was some weird attempt at a rock band, but it did get to the ears of John Hammond. And so some of them managed to cut some very flashy rock records that Hammond declined to issue. But he did have Michael under contract. He thought Michael was a real talent.
And some of those demos have been released that Michael cut with Hammond, I think, in, what, 63 or 64. They've been released on the box set that Al Kooper put together, From His Hands to His Heart to His Head. From His Head to His Heart to His Hands is the name of that. And they're actually, you know, his singing is limited, but it's not bad stuff.
Well, it's show-offy, though, and that was something that he had trouble learning how to, I don't know, modulate or something. He eventually wound up in a band, because it wasn't like Cream, where there was three guys and one of them was the guitarist. He was always there with Elvin Bishop as a second guitarist.
And Butterfield as a virtuoso harmonica player.
Well, yeah, but it was a band, and that was, it was important that nobody dominate the band, including Paul.
Yeah. And so the Bloomfield is sort of drafted into the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. They were not close. Bloomfield was scared of him.
Well, he was even rougher than Big Joe in some ways. I mean, he's a lawyer's son, but he would just like stomp into a club and go, "Let me play." And these black guys would go, "What?" But he was good enough that once he did, you know, they had this attitude, "Oh, let's put this novelty white boy up now." And then they heard him and went, "Well, he's not actually much of a novelty. He's good." Initially, the way they felt about Michael, but then they realized that these people, these white guys, had a real feeling for what they were doing, the black people.
Yeah, and so they start to take him seriously, but Bloomfield doesn't end up in Butterfield's band until two guys from Elektra Records, Joe Boyd and Paul Rothchild, come to Chicago and hear him jamming with Butterfield.
Right. Well, they needed a piano player, and Michael could play blues piano okay, something he'd picked up hanging out in the Fickle Pickle and working with these Bluebird recording artists, former Bluebird artists. And so that's where he was. They did a whole album with him on piano, which Elektra rejected.
And that's the one that's been released as the Lost Butterfield Sessions, right?
Right. So all the lead guitar you hear on there is Elvin Bishop. It was easy enough to find a keyboard player, but not easy enough to find guitar players with the fluidity and the ability to blend in with the rest of the band that Michael had.
Yeah, there's an enormous leap from those tracks to the first Paul Butterfield Blues album, but they spent almost 2 years trying to record the Butterfield band. They tried to record in the studio, then they recorded them live at the Cafe Agogo. And do you have any insight into what the issues were, that they were never happy with what they were getting?
No, I really don't. I should one of these days ask Joe Boyd about that. We can hear that they weren't very good, but then our context is having heard what came later. Some of it may have been that they knew that there would be a lot of negative reaction from the folkies, because this did come out of the University of Chicago Hoot Night scenes, and although very few of the members of the Butterfield band were actual students, it was because it was Chicago, you know, it had to be as good as Chicago blues, and it wasn't yet.
Yeah, and I mean, in Chicago, to my understanding, was sort of unique in the folk scenes in that they had direct access to electric blues played by authentic people like Muddy Waters and Big Joe Williams, and Howlin' Wolf and others who had made the migration from Mississippi to Chicago and switched to electric instruments, so that the kids in Chicago knew that electric blues was legit.
Well, you know, you could go down the street and hear it. Big Joe, by the way, was not an electric player.
Yeah, my bad.
He had a pickup on his 9-string guitar, but that was just for playing in bars. He wasn't doing the same sort of thing that Muddy was doing with sustain and stuff like that. He wasn't doing the kind of stuff that Otis Rush and Magic Sam were doing as far as the younger players. It was a completely different thing. But yeah, I mean, there was Sonny Boy Williamson and Little Walter for harmonica. There was Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf for guitar, and also Wolf did some harmonica. You know, and that was just Chess Records. There were bunches of other labels out there in Chicago. And they got played on the radio, and actually some of those labels were so small that they never got past Chicago or past the, like, number two or three blues station in Chicago. So record collectors go nuts for that. But, you know, you could hear blues anytime you wanted to. Especially on weekends, go down to the Maxwell Street Market, which was a sort of open-air flea market with an emphasis on the fleas. You could get anything down there, usually broken and real junk. But it was also a place where poor people shopped, and there were, you know, players out there who were playing electric blues in the street because they knew they could get tips from these people who were shopping at the Maxwell Street Market.
Yeah,
so, you know, it's pretty hard to... Yeah, you drive down the street and there'd be a blues record shop blasting through one of those awful metal speaker horns into the street.
Yeah, and so Bloomfield and Butterfield didn't have any idea how heretical they were being by playing electric blues as white kids.
No, You know, you get Washboard Sam at the Pickle Pickle. You could get Howlin' Wolf at some club. You know, it was all one thing to them because that was their environment. You know, it would be like, I don't know, jazz musicians in New York, dime a dozen, most of them really good.
And speaking of musicians from New York, around this time, Bloomfield, or a little earlier, meets a New York musician, Bob Dylan, who comes to Chicago to play. And Bloomfield, you tell the story of Bloomfield's initial impression of him was he wasn't that good of a guitarist, and I'm going to go up there and cut him and show him how to play blues. What happened when they met?
Well, Dylan charmed him. He knew he wasn't a good guitar player. I mean, good lord, he was from New York. He was around Dave Van Rock, who was a really, really excellent finger-picking folk guitarist. So Dylan knew about that shortcoming, but they talked. They're both really smart guys, and they had this long conversation, and Bloomfield walked away like, well, gee, you know, he's not as bad as I thought he was. You know, he probably conceived him, coming from New York, you know, the next big thing out of New York as this, you know, once again, wise-ass Jewish kid. But, of course, Michael's antenna were up, and of course he wanted to go into battle with this guy, but the guy wasn't doing that. It was like, you know, some sort of martial art where you just sidestep. And then once they got past that, they turned out to really like each other. You know, a good move for both of them.
Yeah, as it turns out. And so that they end up hanging out for hours. And then when Bloomfield finally sees Dylan play, he's blown away at Dylan's ability to command attention. And I don't think
and
you got that.
And that it wasn't about virtuosity.
Yeah, that it was about the songs.
You could be a fairly basic player in purely musical terms, and still be damned effective.
Yes, and that's sort of a lesson that Dylan imposes on Bloomfield when he gives him a call in 1965 and says, hey, I'm going to cut some records and I'd like you to play. But he says, I don't want any of that B.B. King shit.
Yeah, well, that was what he said when Michael got to the studio. But, I mean, Michael was just amazed that, you know, Dylan even knew how to find him. It wasn't that hard. I mean, Dylan's manager, Albert Grossman, was from Chicago, from the folk scene, ran folk clubs. So, naturally, he knew how to get a hold of Bloomfield. But, you know, Michael was pleased. Oh, look, somebody wants me to play on his record. And, you know, by that time, Dylan was a star. So, this was like a real opportunity.
Yeah, and so Bloomfield, Dylan picks up Bloomfield at the train station in New York City and takes him out to Woodstock. And what's the scene like that Bloomfield discovers around Dylan at this point?
Well, there were a lot of hangers-on, a lot of odd people. But it was also Grossman, who was basically all there was to Woodstock at that point. There were people who had moved up there from New York City, Happy and Artie Traum being a great example of that. But basically, it was just a quiet place close enough to New York City that it was easy enough to get into the big city if you had to. But it was also a place where you could relax and work on stuff.
And Dylan has surrounded himself like hangers-on. Bobby Newworth, it's hard to describe him as just a hanger-on. I mean, he was also basically Dylan's enforcer, I mean, verbally mostly, but they had built this incredibly intimidating machine, Dylan and Newworth, and were, you know, Bloomfield watches them shred Eric Oakes and David Blue with this approach.
Wait, do you mean Phil Oakes?
Yeah, Phil Oakes, I'm sorry. And I was going to introduce Eric Anderson,
aka David Cohen. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, there was this kind of one-upsmanship that Michael really was not impressed or involved with. That was, you know, Dylan's trick. That wasn't for him.
Yeah, but he's unintimidated, And so over the course of 3 days, Dylan shows him the new material, which in 1965, nobody had heard anything like a Rolling Stone.
Right.
And Bloomfield himself says he didn't know what to make of it, that he'd never heard anything like this. And then when he gets the brief not to play any of that B.B. King shit, but to play like Roger McGuinn, he's got to modify his style. He does end up on Tombstone Blues.
I think he was told to play like Roger McGuinn at all.
Yeah.
I think Dylan was just saying, I don't want standard pre-cut blues phrasing on here. I want virtuoso rock and roll guitar, which is why I picked you. And Michael went, okay, I can do that.
And he did.
And he did.
And there's the legendary story of Al Kooper coming to the session as a guitarist, sees Bloomfield walk in from the rain with his guitar not in a case, just loose and wet, wipes his guitar off with a towel, plugs in, and Cooper just quietly puts his guitar away because he knows he's not going
right.
to play. And
he
then
never
moves.
Heard of this guy. Sure wasn't going to compete with him.
Yeah, and then he moves over to Oregon and ends up playing the lead instrument on the track.
Yeah, he did. I mean, he didn't really know how to play the organ, but he knew enough. He probably was down on the musician union as a guitarist, piano player, because he did play the piano. But he'd never really, you know, had much truck with a Hammond organ. But yeah, well, that's partially the mix too. I mean.
Yeah, and you know, it's mysterious as to why Tom Wilson was fired after the recording of Like Rolling Stone. He'd been producing Dylan all the way through his career up to that point, and you know, captures the Like a Rolling Stone take, but might not have even mixed it. Bob Johnson's brought in to finish the rest of the album, and you know, all we know is that Wilson at first didn't want to feature Cooper because he was like, that guy's not an organ player, but Dylan insisted.
Well. There's a couple of things here. Wilson was a really prickly character. He was apparently quite difficult to get along with. Everybody wanted to because he was black. And it was great, you know, to have this hip Negro producer at Columbia. Now, once you were an official producer at Columbia, that you worked for the company. And so I don't know, there might have been something that went on at the session, but the really important thing, I think, was that there was a hiatus because they cut Like a Rolling Stone, and then everybody went to Newport Folk Festival and doing all that. And when they finally reconvened in New York, Wilson was gone. He may have even been, I'm trying to remember what he did next, because, oh, I know, he did Dion. He did that album on Dion that was only released last year.
Huh.
Really good folk rock record.
Huh. And then he went on to sign the Velvet Underground and Frank Zappa to.
Well, he got fired from Columbia, I think, once the Dion album. They didn't do anything with the Dion album. And so, yeah, I mean, here was a hip Negro rock producer at Liberty and definitely Verve, which was a jazz label, wanted in on the rock market because they'd missed it with Ricky Nelson all those years ago. And, you know, rock music was with the Beatles and so forth. It was looking like something was going on there. So naturally they picked up Wilson, and Wilson with his avant-garde taste turned out to be a pretty good match.
Yeah. But back to Dylan and Bloomfield. So this break to go to Newport, is that the weekend that the Butterfield Blues Band played there?
Yeah.
And Dylan Goes Electric. Or Dylan Goes Electric the next year, right? After the song's out?
No.
It's the same year. And so people haven't even heard Like a Rolling Stone yet, but they've heard Subterranean Homesick Blues. And
They put that out immediately.
Oh, okay.
And it went to number one, which is why this whole myth that the folkies hated the thought of Dylan going electric, well, some of them did, but it was the number one song in the country. It wasn't like it was a huge surprise.
Yeah. And so the Butterfield Band goes to Newport. They play a Friday night show. Then Dylan arrives and starts calling people in to rehearse.
Right. But he the first person he calls is Bloomfield, because he knows the Butterfield band's up there. And so Bloomfield was the guy who put the band together.
And he basically just took the Butterfield Blues Band team over there.
And Barry Goldberg.
Yes, his friend Barry Goldberg will show up. And Al Kooper shows up then.
Yeah.
Somehow for the show. But actually, we should probably go back, because the Friday night performance of the Butterfield Blues Band is also part of the legend of the Newport Festival, because Alan Lomax gave them a pretty cutting introduction, and Albert Grossman did not care for this.
Well, Lomax was like revered by the authentic folkies. So this was the big divide in the folk music world in those days. Half of it was authenticity, which is your old black man in overalls playing an acoustic guitar, or, you know, a hillbilly playing a banjo and acoustic guitar, fiddle. That was authentic folk music. There was commercial folk music, like Peter, Paul, and Mary, who were huge. So this was the divide, and somehow, because of the electric instruments, the Butterfield Band was perceived as being commercial, whereas what they were playing was so uncommercial, it was ridiculous. They were playing stuff that they heard in the streets, some of which was written for them by people like Nick Gravanites. I mean, the Born in Chicago, that fantastic lead track on their first album, you know, that's true. That's Nick's actual story. So, yeah, I mean, you weren't supposed to play electric blues. And I remember reading the letters column in Sing Out, which was the Rolling Stone of authentic folkiedom, which also tried to, well, because of their political leanings, they were very friendly to the singer-songwriters, including Bob Dylan. And the letters column, somebody wrote in and said, you know, I don't know if you realize this, but Chuck Berry is a blues man. He plays an electric guitar, but he also plays Chicago blues, not just the pop music we know him for. And so this is something to think about. And, you know, I was like 10 years old or something. I thought, yeah, sure, that makes sense. But that was really a controversial statement. I should go back and find that letter somewhere, because I'd like to know who wrote it. They were right. And from there, it was just a short step to the Rolling Stones.
Which was already going on in England, but not, and it was blowing away the commercial rock world in America, but the folkies were not viewing that stuff as authentic at all, or of anything.
It wasn't even blowing away I'm trying to remember what their first hit here was.
Well, the Stones had multiple top 20 hits by this point in 1965. They went number 9 with The Last Time. Yeah, they went The Last Time went to number 9 on the American pop charts in 1965. And Heart of Stone had been in the top 20. Time Is on My Side was 24, I want to say.
Hang on. I've got the big book of charts.
You don't want to argue with me about Stones trivia.
Okay, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right. And Satisfaction was even...
Yeah, that was the hit of the summer, so...
Right. It was in June.
Yeah, and that was the song of the year, so...
Right. Because it was a protest song, and it was a rock and roll song.
Yeah, but the folkies were not... They viewed that as the pop world, right? That wasn't of concern to them. The Stones weren't showing up at Newport.
No, they weren't. And if they had been, they would have been beaten up.
But Butterfield is showing up. And now, was their album out yet, or it had just been cut?
I think it had just... It was coming. They cut that after Newport. The chronology drove me nuts doing this book. And I got it wrong the first time. It was Like a Rolling Stone, Newport, then back to New York to do the rest of Highway 61, and then get the Butter Band together for the Butters with Bloomfield album. I mean, I don't think anybody slept for about 4 or 5 weeks in there, but it was all done. And I'm fairly sure that the Butterfield album came out in the early fall. It wasn't, you know, back in those days, you only had a couple of tracks and mixing wasn't a really big deal. You had to get it right the first time. So it was a really huge period of creativity on those lines.
Yeah, and Bloomfield has the opportunity to stay with Dylan, and he encourages the other players on the gig to stay with Dylan and is telling him how big he's going to be, but he doesn't want any part of that.
No, he knew very well that he was a blues player, and he'd also had enough history with the Butter Band that he saw that as something he could do with some success, something he could tour with, people he could get along with. I'm pretty sure he didn't want to be hanging around a lot with the likes of Victor Maimondas and Bobby Newworth.
Yeah.
I mean, those were the two, you know, enforcers in the Dylan camp. And there was politics and stuff in the Dylan's camp. Who was cool, who wasn't cool. You know, the Butter Band was just a bunch of guys loading shit into a van and driving around and playing at colleges where people were actually very interested in what they were doing.
Yeah, and you talk about an early version of Born in Chicago that was put on the compilation album that sold 200,000 copies?
Yeah.
That's a big splash in the folk scene. I mean...
But the Blues Project, was it the Blues Project, the Electric Blues Project, or was it the...
I think the Blues Project's on the album, and so is... There's one that's got early Love and Spoonful as well.
Oh, okay. So that's the, I'm trying to remember the name of the thing. It's a compilation. It also has The Powerhouse, which was an early Clapton thing.
There's a whole nexus. And I came across an interview the other day. I hadn't realized this, and I was going to throw this at you as a curveball, but did you realize that Dylan had actually rehearsed with Eric Clapton and Mayall's Blues Breakers a few months before he cut Like a Rolling Stone, or it might have just been weeks?
I've never heard that story.
I found it online.
Where would he have done that?
He did it in England when he was on the tour that was filmed for Don't Look Back. And he called them down, and... whatever they were working on, it didn't produce anything. But that sort of made me wonder if that wasn't the source of Don't Do Any B.B. King Shit. If he hadn't tried to play with Eric Clapton and realized that pure
good question.
Blues guitar
I've
wasn't.
I've never heard this story before. And I do know that he was hanging out with Alan Price from the Animals, because there's an outtake reel from Don't Look Back that has a really hilarious scene of Alan Price taking Dylan to shop for clothes. And in the middle of a woman and her young daughter enter this clothing shop, and they're horrified. Horrified. I mean, if Godzilla had been standing in front of them, they couldn't have been more horrified. It's really worth watching.
Huh. Yeah. So, yeah, May 12th, 1965 in London was when they tried to cut a session with the Blues Breakers. And I want to talk about the Blues Breakers a little bit, because Clapton has had some records out with the Yardbirds. He was on the Five Live Yardbirds album. He was on a few flop singles, Good Morning Little Schoolgirl. He was on their one hit, For Your Love, but then quit immediately. And that's all Americans knew about Eric Clapton, basically nothing, because Jeff Beck replaced him as far as Americans knew. But he's playing with John Mayall.
Back another thing, nobody knew, if it wasn't John, Paul, George, or Ringo, or the Five Rolling Stones, nobody knew the name of anybody in these bands. There was Herman, and who knows who the Hermits were. There was Dave Clark, and who knew who the other four guys were. They just didn't know.
Nobody in America knew about Eric Clapton. Somehow Dylan did, I guess from being in England and getting hip, but...
It might have been Alan Price who told him.
Yeah, it could very well have been. And of course, he was hanging out with Brian Jones and all kinds of other English rock stars at the time, although they were smart enough to stay away from the cameras when Pennebaker was around making the doc. But Clapton and Bloomfield have pretty parallel careers for a while. Bloomfield gets the big jump by being on Like a Rolling Stone, But then the first Paul Butterfield album comes out in the fall of 65. And then spring of 66, the Males Blues Breakers album comes out. And did that make much of a splash in America at the time?
No, it didn't. I mean, once again, enlightened folkies like myself bought it. Because, well, for one thing, I'd heard this Eric Clapton and the Powerhouse track where he's playing a Freddie King song. And it was an instrumental, and I thought that was just great. But I don't think most people were aware of that because even on a low price sampler, once again, people weren't so much tracking the names of the musicians as they were the names of the groups. And since the Powerhouse wasn't really a group and never put out any more records, you know, that was what Clapton was doing after he left Mail. He didn't stay with Mail very long either. Mail is apparently very hard to get along with.
Yeah, a number of guitarists churned through. But anyway, but back to Bloomfield. I mean, there for a minute from 65 all the way through his run with the Butterfield Band, Bloomfield is absolutely on the cutting edge of rock and roll. I mean, he's playing lead guitar on the anthem of rock music, like Rolling Stone. I mean, this was the compass point for where is rock going to go? Well, here's where it's going to go. And then, right, you know, the first Butterfield album is very solid blues, electric blues, played by an integrated band, but led by white kids. And then they followed up in late 66 with East West, which is just a quantum leap musically from what he'd been doing before. And you tell the story of how LSD was involved and the insights that allowed Bloomfield to make that big leap.
Bloomfield and Bishop, they were pretty tight. I mean, they couldn't help but be competitors on stage, but they were both exploring all these new dimensions that were out there, and they had both taken acid and listened to some Indian music that Michael had really gotten into, and they both got it. They understood how the music works, which is pretty counterintuitive for Western ears. They were all listening to all kinds of stuff, and Gravenites had written an instrumental called About Time. I have no idea what that sounded like or even what he thought he was doing. It's something somebody ought to ask him one of these days. And they took that and they played around with these ideas that they'd gotten from the Indian music, and the next thing you know, it was East West. But they also did the Cannibal Adderley work song on the other side of the record, and that's just as important because it's a long track and it isn't blues all that much. Oh, the head is sort of blues, but the improvisations that they do take it all over the place. I really wonder what Cannon and Nat thought about that, when if they even heard it. It was a real interesting approach to a song that could have been a complete disaster in other hands. And so it was very clear that this band, if they needed a hit, you know, which is what Mary Mary is doing on there.
Yeah, and that's written by Michael Nesmith of the Monkees.
Well, Michael was a songwriter long before he joined the Monkees. Michael Sincere or something like that. Michael Darling, I forget, was the name he was using. But I mean, Elektra wanted a hit because they didn't know from album sales. And in fact, giant album sales were, if you weren't the Beatles, they were a thing of the future at that point. So they wanted a hit. And what the Butter Band wanted to do was stretch out, play work song, you know. But these things were huge hits when they were on tour. And, you know, there are several recordings of East West played live from Mark Naftalin's archives. But they were, you know, they were big. They went over big live.
Especially in San Francisco.
Well, yeah, San Francisco, they thought they had the market cornered on what you could do with LSD and an electric guitar. And it was amazing when the Fillmore Auditorium opened up and they booked the Butterfield Band. The Butters came out there and they just laughed. I mean, Butterfield's made some crack about what did these guys think they were doing? And they weren't very proficient. There are only a couple of guitarists. I mean, Jerry Garcia and John Cipollina were probably the only two real guitar players out there. Certainly James Gurley from the Big Brother and the Holding Company wasn't the virtuoso that he thought he was. And so these guys, you know, the blues players get out there and go, what? There's no structure to this stuff. They can't play? Man, we're going to wipe the floor with them. And they did. People came to the shows at the Fillmore and went, wow, where did this come from? Gave people something to think about.
And a direction to follow. I mean, you could argue that the whole Grateful Dead modal jam section comes from East-West. I mean, that...
I'm sure that was part of it, but once again, LSD plays something of a role in the history of the Grateful Dead. And Garcia was also coming from a bluegrass background. Because that was the first thing he did, was this bluegrass thing. And then it turned into jug band music. And then it turned into the Warlocks. But there had already been the acid test down there in Palo Alto and also in San Francisco. So
yeah.
I don't think we can blame the Butters for what they did with the...
you can't blame him for the whole thing. But nonetheless, in 1966, Michael Bloomfield is absolutely on the cutting edge of rock and roll. I mean, two albums with Butterfield were both excellent accomplishments. I still have a hard time, you know, coming to them after the blues rock revolution that they triggered. You know, it was kind of hard to see what was so special about them, you know, as a kid coming back into it from the 80s. East-West was obviously unique, but the first Butterfield album, I think it's hard to recapture the impact it had on the scene in 65.
Right. It's one of those seismic events. You know, you play it and you're not the same afterwards. I can remember hearing it for the first time and going, oh boy, that's going to change things. And then I went to see them at, I believe, Carnegie Hall. And it was like, okay, this is it. There's really something here. I thought it was really important that Michael had his back to the audience the whole time, crouching down and playing next to his amplifier. That was about the first thing I asked him about when I finally met him. He said, you know, why did you do that? He said, oh, my amp was all fucked up. It was the only way I could get it to sound right. So that's not a mystery of the electric guitar? Oh, geez, I thought it was.
So from 65 through 1966, Bloomfield is absolutely at the cutting edge of rock and roll. I mean, you know, playing on the big folk rock single 65, and then leading the first blues rock band in America, white blues rock band in America, and then inventing rock. I mean, you know, East West is up there with 8 Miles High and any other, you know, Yardbird Shapes a thing, one of the most innovative things to happen in 1966. And the future psychedelic scene is all ears. But then in early 67, he suddenly quits the Butterfield Blues Band. What's the story with that?
Insomnia. He had a terrible problem when he was on tour getting to sleep. And there would be days that went by where he slept not a minute. And it was making him nuts. So... you know, it was also the fact that as good as they weren't getting paid like good good musicians.
Yeah, they hadn't had a single, and they weren't playing. The Fillmore scene, Fillmore was ahead of its time a little bit, and
making money. The only people who were making money were the Grateful Dead because they went out and toured relentlessly. But, you know, none of the quote-unquote stars from the original San Francisco scene were making anything. You know, They didn't have record labels. They didn't have record contracts. I mean, they didn't have hit records because they tended to play for 7 or 8 minutes per tune. And Elektra wasn't making any money off of Butterfield. They had Judy Collins to bring in the dough. And they thought maybe that would be the way to go, you know, folk rock.
Up to this point, though, even with quitting Butterfield, he's still keeping pace with Eric Clapton, maybe a little bit behind because Clapton quit Mail and then forms The Cream, which hasn't hit America yet in early 67. And Butterfield conceives of, he has a very big vision for his next band. And let's tease that a little bit because we're going to talk about that on the next episode. What was his vision for an American music band?
Bloomfield?
Yeah, Bloomfield.
Bloomfield.
Bloomfield, yeah.
Michael had never been a blues purist, obviously, or else he couldn't have obeyed Dylan on the like a Rolling Stone session. He had also listened to country music. He listened to folk music. He listened to a lot of stuff. And he had this idea of a band that would encompass all American music, an American music band. And he thought that would be what he wanted to do. He wanted to add horns. He wanted to have a couple of vocalists. He just had this vision of a band that would synthesize American music in a way that the public would respond to. So putting that together was not easy, but the original guy he went to was his old pal, Nick Gravanites. And fortunately, Nick has always been a really solid guy. And so he helped put this band together. And that became the Electric Flag.
And we'll talk about that and the Super Sessions with Al Kooper and the long, sad decline and fall of Michael Bloomfield in part two of our series about Ed's book on Michael Bloomfield, which comes out in paperback this summer of 2018. Right. July of 2018. So thank you, Ed, and we'll be back very soon to talk about the rest of Michael Bloomfield's life. This is Nate Wilcox for Let It Roll. Thanks for listening. Next week, Ed and I will finish the story of Michael Bloomfield, covering his dream band, his biggest commercial successes with Al Kooper, and his decline and fall. Be sure and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com to access the YouTube playlists and hear the music we're talking about. Ed Ward's Michael Bloomfield, The Rise and Fall of an American Guitar Hero, is available from Chicago Review Press, wherever fine books are sold.